We are talking once again with Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. So we had planned to have Job today, but he's having technical difficulties connecting.
Yes. Yes. So
that's putting it nicely. Yeah. But something we can all relate to.
Regular updates. I mean, with the whole work from home business, I think everybody can sympathize with that, having computer issues because there's an update that needs to be installed and then it changes things and then you're kind of lost. So we'll work a little harder to try to get him, ready for next week so he can be back on the show.
Yeah. And this is why you should cooperate when, phone calls come to you randomly saying that they're from technical support and they just want to help you.
No.
Okay. I guess that I wasn't supposed to do that.
No.
Moving on.
Okay.
So starting out with local and Mayor Harrell announcing.
Yeah, this week. Mayor Bruce Harrell announced a new search committee for the Seattle Police Department chief. Harrell had announced a new search committee, who will assist him in the search for a new chief of police. He had encouraged the current interim chief, Adrian Diaz, to apply for the permanent job, saying that he was very satisfied with Diaz. And Diaz has in fact applied for the permanent job, but the city is required under the city charter to do a nationwide search for a position as important as a new police chief. In addition, the court-appointed monitor, Antonio Oftili, just said in his report to the court in the past week or so that Seattle must seek a new police chief from outside the department if we want to change the culture at SPD, and he kind of highlighted that as one of the necessary steps to get us through the police reform process. So Bruce Harrell announced the new search committee this week, and that committee will collect applications through July 5th, then evaluate the candidates and recommend up to 5 finalists for Mayor Harrell to choose from. Harrell will then select a candidate from those 5. He'll submit the name to the city council, and the city council will interview that person and then vote to confirm or maybe not confirm them as the new police chief for Seattle. So the list of 14 people on the search committee, I found this quite interesting. Right at the top, of course, is Council President Deborah Juarez. And also council member and chair of the Public Safety Committee, Lisa Herbold. So those 2 folks were right kind of at the top of the list. And then, of course, Lieutenant Scott, I think his last name is pronounced Bachler, of the Seattle Police Management Association. So you knew there was going to be a member of SPD management on the committee, and he's the one. And then Prachi Dave of the Public Defender Association, and Dave also sits on the Community Police Commission, is a member of the committee. Also, Natalie Walton Anderson of the City Attorney's Office. She's the head of the Criminal Division. So right there you have a member of the Public Defender Association and a member of the city's prosecuting body, so prosecutor and a defender. And then Reverend Harriet Walden, co-chair of the Community Police Commission, will also be on the search committee. And then Gabe Galanda is managing partner of the Galanda Broadman PLLC law firm, which specializes in native rights issues, is also sitting on the committee. And Esther Lucero, who's CEO of the Seattle Indian Health Board. I think every time I look at one of these committees, special committees, I see Esther Lucero's name on it. She's a busy woman. And then Mary Ellen Stone, who is CEO of the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center, is also on the committee. Bishop Reggie Witherspoon of Mount Calvary Christian Center in the CD. He's also on the committee. And Robert Sacca is a police reform advocate and a former Air Force veteran. He recently served on the King County Charter Review Commission, where he helped draft and pass those three key police reform amendments to the city charter that voters voted on and passed in 2020 that changed and strengthened police reform of the King and police and oversight of the King County Sheriff's Office. So he's a very good appointee on this commission. And then we get down to the last three appointees. And I know up to this point you've been thinking, huh, this is not bad, right?
Yeah.
And then you get to the last three. We have Jim Pugel, former Seattle Police Department police chief, right? And you might be thinking, oh, that's not so bad, right? And then you get to the last two, and of course, they're the usual suspects. Rachel Smith, president and CEO of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce.
Of course.
And Aaron Goodman, executive director of the SoTo Business Improvement Area.
Wow.
Right? So it looks like a great list until you get down to those last two, right? And it's not. And I have to point out, too, that it's not usually the Seattle Police Department reps or even someone like Jim Pugel, a former police chief, who are the most reactionary on this type of issue. The ones who will stand up and beat their chest about crime and we need someone who's tough and et cetera, et cetera. It's usually the well-heeled business community representatives who kind of come into something like this with the expectation that money equals influence, right? And their vote and their voice matters more than anyone else's. So it'll be interesting to see.
It could very well be, the expected quid pro quo of chamber support that they have been appointed, multiple seats at numerous tables for the Harrell administration.
Yeah. And, did we expect anything different from the Harrell administration? I think the answer to that is no. We don't really expect anything different.
Exactly.
And you could also, some folks who are pushing really hard for police reform could also point out too that a lot of the folks sitting on this committee are some of the same people who have been sort of okay with just making minor adjustments to the status quo all along, and that it would have been more helpful to have someone, maybe BLM Seattle King County or someone from one of the more vocal police reform groups or public safety reform might be a better name for it. One of the public safety reform groups who are asking that the city slim down the duties of the police department and put more resources to other places. But then again, it's a search committee for a new police chief. It's not a search committee for options for how we change and reimagine public safety, right? So we'll see what they come up with. And we'll see. I think it's very, very important that we do look outside the police department or look outside of the city of Seattle, actually, for someone to run the police department for the same reasons that Oftili pointed out in his report, that we need new blood. We need somebody who is experienced with police reform, experienced with making sure that officers connect with the communities that they're supposed to be serving, and that who has a broader idea of what public safety means than just sending a guy with a gun to every incident. And that's going to be interesting because, of course, one of the criticisms I've had of the court monitor is that he compares Seattle's police reform progress with other departments around the United States and doesn't look, say, overseas or look at what the standards are in other countries around the world, particularly developed nations around the world. And, if you're looking and drawing from a pool of potential candidates from other police departments around the country, are you going to get somebody who's better? I think one of the things that made Kathleen O'Toole good is that she was from Ireland. Okay. And so she had an understanding not just of the police reform process and how to make change happen, but she also had a different set of expectations for what the department could be. And I think that might be really, really important to look for as well.
So tangential to that, I know that the City of Seattle is in the process of replacing Andrew Meyerberg, who was head of the OPA and now is working in some other faction of the city.
He's now working as Mayor Harrell's public safety czar.
Yeah. Yeah. And made his first public appearance, I think, at last week's public safety committee meeting. Mm-hmm. But so they're looking for a replacement, and supposedly on June 23rd, they're going to have a forum where they are going to be presenting the three finalists. So that's like a, you know, a month away, basically, mm-hmm. for that position. And the South Seattle Emerald is doing a survey looking for everyone's opinion on what they would like to see in the new OPA director and what questions they would ask if given the chance. So,
yeah. So if you follow this process a lot and you have some pretty serious questions for, or some serious ideas for how to improve the police oversight bodies, or you're concerned about the performance of the police oversight bodies, now may be the time to formulate a really good question or a couple of questions and hop on over there and send that to them. Do you have the website for that?
I don't have a simple website link for that. It's at the South Seattle Emerald.
Okay.
I will post to both our Facebook and Twitter feeds the link to that article so that people can access it from that.
And it's one of Carolyn Bick's articles?
Hang on. I don't know if it's actually a Carolyn Bick article or if it's just a generic.
Doesn't matter too much, but you can go over to the South Seattle Emerald. You can Google them, go to their website, and I would recommend just reading through some of their articles, getting familiar with that publication. And I'm sure they would have a link to where you can take their survey and suggest questions.
The title of the article is Poll Emerald Readers P's and Q's for OPA Director Candidates.
People want to use the
search engine to find that.
Yeah. And they, keep in mind when you go to the South Seattle Emerald website that they're very much pro making big changes in the police reform process to make public safety align with the needs of communities of color in Seattle. So be kind to them. You know, you can express frustration with the police oversight bodies in Seattle, particularly the OPA, but be very kind to the Emerald folks because they do great work.
And again, they're going to be collating people's responses and then presenting that to the city and the committee. So see them as a conduit towards getting your concerns there. The specific questions they ask are, what are your priorities when it comes to hiring Seattle's new director? What questions will you ask the final three candidates? And what do you want these OPA director candidates to know about the job and your expectations?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the Emerald is doing this and not the city of Seattle itself.
Well,
of course, you can always submit this kind of stuff to Lisa Herbold, the chair of the Public Safety Committee, too.
Yeah, but it's good to cover your bases and send to multiple outlets when doing things.
Yeah.
Like this.
Mm-hmm. But some folks feel more trust that their voice will be heard if they go through the Emerald because they're used to going to the Emerald for their community news.
Mm-hmm. And the Emerald can collate if, you know, multiple people ask the same question, they can, you know, collate that and say, hey, our most popular question was.
Yeah, we had X number of people ask something similar to this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So something that people should be looking for online. All right.
So okay.
on,
So on to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority this week. This week, Publicola reported that the King County Regional Homeless Authority will soon be asking its board to vote on a budget increase for 2023 that would approximately double the agency's budget, almost double the agency's budget. Everyone's been expecting a request for more funding, right? But not necessarily that much money, right? This year's budget for the agency is $119 million, and the city of Seattle has contributed about $80 million of that, or just shy of 70%. The rest comes from the King County government budget. And of course, Andrew Lewis this week helpfully pointed out that Seattle residents also pay taxes to the county. So that means that Seattle residents are subsidizing both the city's 70% and the county's 30%. So, you know, we're actually residents of Seattle are actually paying much more than 70%. There are currently 40 suburban cities in King County that receive services that are funded from by the King County Regional Homelessness Authority's budget, but only Seattle and King County foot the bill for the agency. Now, so if the King County Regional Homelessness Authority Board approves the funding request, the agency will be asking for an additional $54 million from the City of Seattle budget directly from the City of Seattle budget next year, but only the city budget. The city budget is already expected to have at least a $34 million budget hole because of the expiration of COVID-19 grants from the federal government and the loss of certain one-time funding sources that helped to fill the budget hole this year. So what would the additional money for the Regional Homelessness Authority be used for? Well, they've got a list of several things, but they kind of group all into five main categories. $20 million would fund 55 additional high acuity beds for homeless people with medical needs, and that includes people with mental health conditions that are keeping them on the street and making it difficult for them to stay up to date on their medications and to stay stable and able to get control of their lives. $20 million would go to purchase buildings for 345 units of permanent supportive and transitional housing to help bridge the gap between emergency shelter and permanent housing. $5 million would go for 6 or 7 safe parking lots for people living out of their vehicles, and that would serve about 800 to 900 vehicles. Of course, it might be more than that number of people because some vehicles have more than one person living out of them. Sometimes a whole family might be living out of an RV or a truck. Millions more in this new budget request would go for emergency shelters, including additional shelters that would serve people during severe weather events. And then, of course, the agency wants funding to hire more staff to ramp up their response. So let's just look back at some of the numbers that I talked about a couple of weeks ago when I last talked about the demographics of the homeless in Seattle. So the most recent one-night count showed that 47% of the homeless in King County are unsheltered people. So the majority of the homeless are actually already in some kind of emergency or temporary shelter. Almost half of that 47% of the unsheltered, almost half of those folks are living in a car or other vehicle. 21% are living in unsanctioned tent encampments. 15% are sleeping bare on the street. So, you know, just kind of laying down in a doorway or sleeping on a park bench or under bushes, or maybe they don't sleep at all. Maybe they wander all night and just kind of snooze on a park bench during the day when it's warm.
Yeah. Shiloh Jama, who was the former director of the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, once pointed out to me, said, literally, the most dangerous thing a homeless person can do is go to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. And so you will see that if you're up late at night, if you're walking around downtown, or maybe you're in some other inner city neighborhood, you'll see homeless people just kind of wandering, trying to stay warm, trying to stay safe when at a time of day when they're most vulnerable. Okay. And then 13% of the unsheltered homeless are squatting in abandoned buildings, which are almost certainly not safe places for them to be. So the most urgent, but you look at this list of folks and you realize that the most urgent number to house are those 800 or so folks who are sleeping bare or wandering all night. And they often are folks who have mental health conditions or other behavioral issues. And that's why they're not able to join a tent encampment or live in a group on, you know, of other people. They're kind of on their own. And that's, of course, what the high acuity and permanent supportive housing is meant to address, to help get those folks stabilized and off the street. Those are probably the highest risk homeless folks and the ones who are often the most visible and the most troubling to folks who complain about the homeless, right? So what's interesting is that a chunk of these additional dollars is meant to get approximately 400 of those 800 people off the street. So you look at that and you go, wow, that's pretty good. If we could do that in 1 year, that would take a big chunk out of the most, the highest risk group of homeless people, the folks who are at most risk on the street. Mm-hmm. In addition, the money to set up 6 or 7 safe parking lots could go a long way towards providing stability for about another 800 to 900, or about one third of the 2,700 or so folks who are living out of their cars and other vehicles. And it would help stop the cycle of people getting their cars towed and ending up in a tent encampment or ending up sleeping bare on the street or needing, you know, emergency shelter that could go to somebody in a tent encampment, et cetera. So,
and when those cars get towed, there's incredibly high fees that are attached to that. Both
so they can
losing the car,
yeah,
getting
they lose
it out
the
of-
car. They lose all of their possessions that are in the car. It can be devastating, and they can end up, like I said, sleeping bare on the street in really dire circumstances.
But
so
also
getting
burdened with additional finances to get the car out of hawk and or, you know, pay for the ticketing and the fines that accrue over that and the cascading number mm-hmm. of tickets that occur when someone doesn't respond immediately to, you know, the city issuing those, then they get warrants issued against them. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just a downward spiral. So yeah. Those 6 or 7 safe parking lots are another very, very important piece of this funding proposal. So while we might say, wow, another $90 million for that agency, that's just too much money, I think the better response is what Seattle City Council Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda told Publicola this week. She said something along the lines of, quote, with Seattle currently funding 68% of the budget, it underscores that regional funders are necessary, end quote. Yeah, exactly. In other words, other cities in King County should start ponying up some cash to help fund the agency. And, you know, it also opens the question again of where are the private funders, including the tech billionaires, who were going to get behind an effective regional solution to homelessness. You know, I just want to say to them, now's your chance, right, to spend some of those excess millions that you could never spend in one lifetime. I mean, some of these folks are so wealthy that, in fact, their children and their grandchildren could never spend all that money. You know, and instead of saying, well, we're going to do our own private foundation funding, et cetera, you know, we've got a regional response, and this regional agency is proposing real solutions to tackle a big chunk of the folks who are currently homeless in Seattle. They've identified who the folks most at risk are. They've got a plan. They've broken it into stages, into manageable chunks, and now they're saying, we just need the dollars. Well, now it's time for folks with the dollars to start saying, okay, here's the money. Right. I think we're going to have to wait and see how the city council is going to be, and the mayor, because of course the mayor is going to be proposing a budget plan for the city council to consider. Usually the mayor proposes that in August or September, usually by early September. And then the city council sits down in September and October, works through it and makes changes. We'll have to see what the city council gets from the mayor and what changes they make, and whether the city council has any options for additional revenue.
Well, hopefully our current mayor will have a better understanding of how budgets and math works than the previous one.
Than the previous one, who often made proposals that just didn't balance.
Yeah.
Or didn't make a lot of sense, you know, shifting things around to make what looked like cosmetic changes say, hey, we did this and we funded that, when in fact she was really just shifting dollars around, making it harder for the city council to fund programs that had been ongoing for years and needed money. Durkin wanted to cut those. It'll be interesting to see what kind of a budget we get from Mayor Bruce Harrell and what kind of shape it's in.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, he was a city council member, unlike Durkin, who had been an attorney working on various legal issues, and, you know, she didn't really have fiscal experience. It'll be interesting to see if Harrell does a better job.
Well, he should, having worked in the sausage factory prior, so.
The sausage factory of the city council, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Anything else on Regional Homeless Authority?
Nope.
All right, well, staying with the category of King County.
So King County Executive Dow Constantine this week proposed doubling the conservation futures property tax. Okay, you're asking, what the heck is that? So currently, a portion of the property taxes that King County residents pay goes to the Conservation Future Program, about 3.12 cents per thousand of assessed value, or about $31 per year if you have a home that's assessed at $1 million. Now, remember, the median sales price for a home in the city of Seattle right now is about $1 million. Okay. So whereas politicians sometimes cite an older median home assessed value of around $600,000, I think it's important to acknowledge that people's assessed values of their homes has been rising right along with the price of home sales.
Yeah,
in their area.
The 600K figure now applies to those who have mother-in-law apartments out back.
Right, it applies, and only applies to the mother-in-law apartment.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's instead of using, you know, 500 to 600,000, let's use the real figure of $1 million. Okay, $1 million assessed property value. Okay, again, that money goes to fund the acquisition of open space and undeveloped property in King County. And they use that money to create parks, wetlands, and to help preserve farmland. So King County Executive Constantine is proposing that the King County Council vote on a plan to double the property tax to 6.25 cents per thousand assessed value. So if you have a home that's assessed about $1 million, you'd pay $62 per year. The money would be used to acquire or place conservation easements on land that falls into six categories. So trails, for folks who love to get out into nature and walk, the trails would be, it would help to acquire and develop trails. So also river corridors, so again for salmon habitat and other fish species. It would be very helpful to preserve or restore, because I think a lot of the money in recent years has been used to restore salmon habitat in places like the Cedar River watershed. Farmland is the third category, We see that a lot with people selling their farms if they can't make a living at farming anymore, or their kids grow up and decide they want an easier office job. They sell their farmland and it gets paved over and redeveloped. Well, and then it's no longer available for people who want to get into and start farming. But if the, yeah, but if the county can place a conservation easement that requires it remained farmland, then that narrows the pool of people who can purchase the land when a farmer sells, and it ensures it can hold down the price of that land since it can't be developed for a quote unquote higher use. and hopefully holds down the price of it a little bit so that new farmers can get into the game. It also preserves local food production. You know, we talk about trying to buy local, right? That's getting harder and harder with food in King County because so much land has been developed from farmland into, you know, warehouse space, server farms. It's been paved over for housing developments, et cetera. So preserving that's important.
Yeah, but I think it's also important to weave in there that it's if the people, if the entity acquiring it to continue farming is also local and, let's say, mom and pop oriented, as opposed to large agribusinesses purchasing farmland, you know, or investment outlets like, you know, Blackstone coming in and, oh, hey, people are going to need food. They're really desperate for food now. Let's get on this whole farming thing and buy up all the pea patches, you know.
Right. So there is that. And then the fourth category is forests, right? So when you're talking about climate change, what really serves as one of the best ways to pull CO2 out of the air is planting trees and preserving the older or the mature forests that we have now, rather than letting them be cut down, which actually releases CO2 into the air. And then the fifth category is urban green space. Again, more parks for folks who live in suburbs and cities. That's always welcome. And, of course, preserving natural land. So natural land is something outside of mature forests, things like wetlands, for example, which can be really vital for also cutting down on the release of CO2 emissions. It can also help a lot, and Constantine actually said this, it can help a lot to provide buffer zones to protect people from flooding, right? It's the loss of wetlands often in low-lying areas that lead to a lot more flooding, and flooding has become an annual problem in some parts of King County. So preserving those low-lying natural lands that are not forest, but that are places that are seasonal lakes or seasonal swamps, can be really, really important for making sure that you're reducing the release of CO2 into the air, but you're also trying to mitigate the harm that is happening with heavy rainfall and flooding every year now.
Which also applies to the farmland as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, it does. Because farmland is often in low-lying areas. And, you know, I mean, in terms of sustainable farming, one part of the sustainable farming practice is making sure that there are wildlife habitat corridors, that you're providing enough of a buffer zone between a nearby river and your farmland so that farm waste doesn't flow into the river. That there's enough ground there in between your fields and the river to filter any waste that could be coming off the farm. And it also means that your fields probably are going to be less likely to flood because there's some place for the rain to go. And if the river overruns its banks, there's at least a buffer zone, right? So all that's really a good idea. And Constantine is asking the county council to approve the tax increase so that it can then go to voters in November. And, of course, voters will have the last say. So we will probably see this again. And, of course, the King County Council may make changes to his proposal. We'll see if they do. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So I understand that city is looking at redistricting. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. When we went to city council districts, from elections where we just all voted on the same, on all candidates in the city council, part of the plan was that as the population grew in the city of Seattle, the district boundaries could be redrawn to ensure that an equal number of, an approximately equal number of Seattle residents were in each district. Okay. So with, in the wake of the 2020 census, it's now time. This is the year when the city council districts will be redrawn. And there is, in fact, a group of five commissioners sitting on a commission to redraw the city council districts. I'll just go through them pretty quickly here. The chair is Eliseo Juarez, who's director of equity and environmental justice for the Washington Department of Natural Resources. So this is the person who will be representing racial and income equity on the commission. Underneath the chair is Patience Malaba, the executive director of the Housing Development Consortium of Seattle King County. Also, Greg Nichols, former mayor of Seattle.
Wow, had to dust him off.
I know. I know. And then two other commissioners, Rory O'Sullivan, who is administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. So a person who is an electoral reform activist and who helped put in place the democracy vouchers, helped get the democracy vouchers initiative passed in Seattle. So a very good member of the commission. And the final member is Nilima Shah, the senior program officer for the Bullitt Foundation, one of the big environmental foundations in the city. But Shaw is also, I think, buddies with the Harrell administration. So she's one of those folks who pops up, you know, members of the Bullitt Foundation occasionally pop up on boards like this. So, and I would say that Shaw and Nichols were the ones appointed by Jenny Durkin, because she set up this commission, not Bruce Harrell. And then Juarez and O'Sullivan were appointed by the city council. Juarez is the chair, the racial and income equity person. And O'Sullivan, again, is the electoral reform activist who worked on democracy vouchers. And then the commissioners appointed Patience Malaba. So they consulted with each other and agreed to appoint her. Now, they have four draft plans for redrawing the districts already. And I just want to very briefly describe those four plans. Plan one is just, I call it the algorithm only plan. And it says the boundaries for plan one were generated by an algorithm with no data beyond current districts and census block populations. So essentially, they put in they updated the population numbers for each census block, and they let the algorithm run and make a decision. And before I actually talk about the plans, I want to mention that population grew grew most in District 7. So District 7, which is Magnolia, Queen Anne, Belltown, Downtown, the population grew there more than anywhere else in the city. But
That's weird.
Also,
I read distinctly in the media that Seattle was dying, and that was the most impacted area of the city.
Yes,
seems to contradict that.
Huh. Yeah, it does seem to contradict that, doesn't it? And then two other districts also saw a big boost in population. That's District 3, which is the CD and Capitol Hill primarily, and some parts south of the CD, like I think North Beacon Hill stretches down to North Beacon Hill. And then District 4, which is the district you live in, Mike. That's the one just north of the Ship Canal, which is, you know, U District, Ravenna, Sandpoint, et cetera. So those are the places that gained population. And so the algorithm came up with a plan that I don't think would be great for Lisa Herbold in District 1, although District 1 needs to gain some territory while these three districts that I mentioned need to lose some territory. Okay. So her plan, the plan for plan one, the algorithm only plan, would add blocks in parts of Pioneer Square, the Central Business District, and the CID to Lisa Herbold's district, which could add a conservative element to the folks who vote for the representative from District 1. That could be difficult for Lisa Herbold. District 3 could actually improve a bit for Shama Sawant. It would add blocks in South Lake Union, depending on how residents of South Lake Union view her. It would remove blocks in East Lake and a portion of Portage Bay and Roanoke Park, and those are wealthy parts of North Capitol Hill. So it could be good for Shama Sawant. And then District 7 would have Magnolia, Inner Bay, Queen Anne, and Belltown. It would have much of the Denny Triangle and the Central Business District, Denny Triangle, but then would lose portions of the Central Business District. So those would be split between districts 1, 3, and 4. Okay. So that could be interesting, for the candidates in District 7 to lose some of that downtown area, which could change the dynamic of voters in District 7. So plan 2 is, I call it the algorithm adjusted. And, it reads, quote, the boundaries for plan 2 were generated by the same algorithm as plan 1, but with the census blocks grouped by a combined overlay of neighborhood, school district, urban village, and community reporting area boundaries. So they essentially let the algorithm run, but then they just kind of tweaked the edges of the boundaries to make sure that school districts stayed together, urban villages stayed together, and community reporting area boundaries were followed. So it's the algorithm adjusted. And it does follow the existing district boundaries pretty closely. So not a whole lot changes. However, District 2 would get a chunk from District 3. So, for example, District 2 could change in a way that wouldn't necessarily be good for Tammy Morales. So it would gain most of Leschi and Madrona and portions of Judkins Park. And that could mean more of the wealthy folks who live along the lake there. Okay. District 3 could, again, lose the wealthy neighborhoods of Madrona and Leschi, Montlake, and Madison Park, and portions of Madison Valley, which would move to District 4. So that could be good for Shama. I don't know. District 4 would gain Wallingford and portions of the it would lose Wallingford, and portions of the University District in Roosevelt would move over to District 6. So over into Dan Strauss's district. So that could be interesting. And then District 5, most of Lake City Way would be lost. And I know Deborah Juarez currently always touts the improvements that she's won for District 5 as reasons for her reelection. So that could make it a little more difficult for her as well. And then District 7, the downtown, Belltown, Queen Anne, et cetera, it would become more residential because the downtown central business district would be split between districts 1, Lisa Herbold, and district 3, Shama Sawant, again, making it a little bit harder for them. So that's kind of an interesting plan, but it would hew a little more closely to the current district boundaries, but it would definitely alter them in interesting ways. Plan 3, And I'm just going to very briefly read. The boundaries for Plan 3 were manually delineated to follow arterials and unofficial neighborhood boundaries. So this is probably the first time that folks on the commission jumped in and decided we're going to manually draw this up. and we're going to follow, quote unquote, unofficial neighborhood boundaries, and we're going to, you know, use major arterials to help us figure out what those boundaries should be. And, that alters it quite a bit. But it also, you can tell they're thinking about how do we preserve the current, council members for some of the districts. So for example, you don't see a huge change in District 1. It just crosses over and spans the Duwamish River for the first time to include Soto and a portion of Beacon Hill west of 15th Avenue near Georgetown, which could be, make very little difference for Lisa Herbold. District 2, for example, it would extend into the Central Business District and include portions of Pioneer Square. Portions of Mount Baker and Judkins Park are also added. So that, again, might make it a little bit harder for Morales, but then it would unite most of the International District, and that wouldn't necessarily be bad for her, right? Then District 3 would remain Capitol Hill, but it would add South Lake Union. It would continue to have the Central District, and it would have Madrona, Leschi, it would have Madrona and Leschi, but then Madison Park and Montlake would move north to District 4. So that would be probably really good for Shama Sawant. District 4 would be similar to its current boundaries, but it would just add Montlake and Madison Park, but then it would also take all of Eastlake. Okay.
Wow.
District 5, again, would extend west into Greenwood to 8th Avenue Northwest, and a portion of Blue Ridge would be taken away from it and given to District 6, which would get that portion of Blue Ridge, and it would get a portion of Fremont and then lose a little bit of Greenwood, okay? And then District 7 would probably change the most, although it says it's similar to existing boundaries. But it has South Lake Union and downtown east of I-5 would move all the way over to District 3. Okay, that would go to Shama. And Pioneer Square, so it would lose that sort of downtown area that borders the International District, would move to District 2. So District 7, I think, would change the most. And it could make District 7 more conservative and be an issue for Andrew Lewis. Okay, so that's plan three. Plan four, and I'm just going to read you very briefly what it says. The boundaries for plan four were manually delineated to prioritize Seattle's unofficial neighborhood boundaries, major arterials, and census block boundaries. So it'd be very similar to plan three, except that it would then also include the census block boundaries. So again, not a whole lot of changes from Plan 3, but some significant changes. So for example, District 1 would instead of all of Pioneer, you know, the bulk of Pioneer Square going to District 2, District 1 would gain a portion of Pioneer Square. District 3 would add the Central Business District and most and the CID, as well as portions of Denny Triangle and the South Lake Union area. Leschi and Judkins Park would move to District 2. And at the north end, parts of Madison Park, Broadmoor, Montlake, and Portage Bay would move north to District 4. Again, you have to look at that and go, okay, would that help Shama or would it not? I mean, she'd lose some of the wealthiest parts of the neighborhood, of the district. But then she'd also gain, you know, Denny Triangle and South Lake Union. You know, how are the tech bros likely to vote, right? So.
Well, she'd gain the Amazon balls.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know if she'd gain the Amazon balls, but I'd have to look very closely at the district boundaries, but she might. And then District 7, of course, has to change in all of these plans because it gained the most in population. It would retain Magnolia, Inner Bay, Queen Anne, and Belltown. So the residential areas, the main residential areas of the district, most of the Central Business District and portions of South Lake Union and Denny Triangle would move to District 3, and Pioneer Square would move to District 1. So those are the four draft plans right now. Currently, the Seattle redistricting commission is doing public meetings, some of them online and some of them are supposed to be live and in person. Many of those meetings, they have not announced a place, although they do have times listed for them. And if you want to see, if you want to give public comment in written form, you can go to their website, and I'll give you the website address. It's www.seattle.gov/ and the word redistricting. Okay, that's the website address. You can go there. You can check the schedule to see when the next meeting will be. You can sign up to, you can add the meeting times to your calendar. You can sign up to give testimony at the online meetings or join the online meetings when they occur. You can see these individual plans. You can look at the map boundaries. You can really dig into all of this if you're interested. And again, I'll give that website address again, www.seattle.gov/redistricting.
Gotcha.
Okay. So I encourage people to dig into that if you're interested.
Well, even if you're not, you should take a look at it.
You should at least take a look at how
it's going to impact you. It's going to impact elections in the future and all sorts of things. All right. Moving on. Just under 10 minutes left. Gun production is up this year, and I know there's a lot of shareholders that are really happy about that.
Yeah. And, you know, I could talk about the shootings that happened this week, particularly the one in Buffalo, New York, but there's a lot in the mainstream media about that. I wanted to talk about kind of the systemic issues behind these frequent shootings. And one of them is just the wide availability of weapons in the United States. And this week, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms helped me out with that by releasing their first comprehensive count of the number of firearms manufactured annually in the United States. The last report that they released on this topic was back in 2000. So the fact that they're releasing one now is partly because the Biden administration is requiring them to do it, and previous administrations have not been requiring them to do it. But Joe Biden, that was one of his things that he wanted to, you know, how can we address the epidemic of gun violence if we don't have good statistics? And that's meant reforming what kind of reporting requirements police departments make to the ATF and what kind of data the ATF collects. So this year they released their first report in 20 years. So they looked at 2021 compared to the year 2000, and they found that the number of guns has approximately tripled, the number of guns manufactured within the United States from 3.9 million in the year 2000 to 11.3 million in 2021. In that same 20-year time period, the U.S. population didn't double or triple. It grew by just 18%. Okay, just to give you a reminder there. And I just want to also talk a little bit about the fact that some people might say, well, those guns are for export, right? But the ATF looked at that and they found that only a very small percentage of those guns are actually exported overseas. So this count is a very accurate reflection of the demand here in the United States for lethal weapons. That increase has been largely driven by demand for semi-automatic handguns. Okay, they make up the biggest bulk of the increase. Weapons that I need to point out are designed to kill people or to provide a unique thrill at the shooting range, not designed for hunting or for sport shooting. Okay. And because that, these 9mm pistols, because they make up the bulk, these little 9mm guns, they make up the bulk, these semi-automatics, they make up the bulk of this increase. Because they're so small and portable, they can also be very easily stolen. They can be lost easily, and they can be mishandled by children who find them, lightweight and easy to handle. and attractive as toys. Okay. In addition, police agencies reported to the ATF that they had recovered 19,344 privately made firearms. Okay, what are those? You're asking, right?
Oh, I know what those are.
Yeah, these are called ghost guns because they're assembled by the owners from kits purchased online or at gun shows or assembled from parts. And that number is a tenfold increase from 2016, the last time the ATF counted ghost guns. So they didn't double or triple. That number didn't double or triple. It increased by 10 times the number that police agencies recovered in 2016. That's an enormous increase, literally an explosion. In California, for example, ghost guns make up about half of the weapons that police departments recover from crime scenes. Okay. Now, a 2018 small arms survey estimated that there were 400 million guns total in the United States. Probably a conservative estimate. But given the population at the time, that's at least one gun for every man, woman, and child living in the United States in 2018, with 73 million extras left over. Just, I don't know, to play with, I guess. Now, the report showed that handgun production in particular skyrocketed during three periods in the last 20 years. The first time that they skyrocketed was the re-election of Barack Obama in 2013 and fear that gun owners had that he would increase gun regulations in the wake of some major shootings that had recently happened. Okay. That was the first big surge. The second surge was in 2016 with Donald Trump's campaign and election. And then the third major surge was in 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic and possibly also because of the George Floyd protests. Okay. Now they didn't survey, you know, no one that I know of has recently surveyed people as to why they went out and purchased more guns. But, I think there may also be just this general sense that the world is reaching a crisis with the pandemic, with climate change, with, extremism in politics and, with, you know, being able to watch something like the January 6th riot at the Capitol, at the U.S. Capitol. You know, people have a sense that society is becoming unstable and apparently, which is true, which is true, but apparently nothing makes Americans feel more safe than having a pistol. Right. And I just kind of feel like, well, if that were true, right, then everywhere else but the United States would be in the middle of terrible chaos and societal breakdown. Right. Including places in Europe where, you know, it's not legal to own guns unless you're a member of some kind of law enforcement agency. And even then, many, many members of law enforcement agencies in Europe don't carry guns with them when they do their job. And that's just not the case. Right. So having a pistol in your drawer at home or in the glove box of your car isn't necessarily going to make you safer. Okay. And we've seen that, in fact, carrying a pistol in the glove box of your car really increases your risk of having your car broken into and getting that stolen and then having that weapon used in a crime. Okay. So the ATF also pointed out that imported guns have also doubled in the past 10 years from 2 million in 2010 to 4 million in 2020. So even though we have a surfeit of domestic gun production and domestic gun companies producing weapons for the hot U.S. market, there's still a demand for imported weapons as well. So not even having a booming domestic gun industry makes the gun lovers feel safe. Okay. And I want to point out, too, that rifles are also an issue. It's not just handguns, especially semi-automatic rifles like the one we saw that shooter use to kill 13 people in Buffalo, New York this week. again, those, you know, semi-automatic rifles, they're weapons for killing people. They're not for hunting or for sport shooting. So that wraps up my look at U.S. gun production.